You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading for the first time of the entire collected works, volume 175 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, and another small cycle in that called Human Life in a Cosmic Context. We are on the titular section here, Building Stones, second lecture in the series of 10, which is numbered in the book, sorry for the confusion, lecture 9, given in Berlin on the 3rd of April, 1917, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. On this occasion, the mystery of Golgotha will be the focus of our studies, which have been prepared by what I have presented in the previous lecture. Let us recall the most important points that relate to this theme. Last time I mentioned that an essential part of any true and inwardly satisfying knowledge of the world is the insight that both the various aspects of the cosmos and the various elements of man's being need to be studied in the light of the three principles of body, soul, and spirit. This is something that must urgently be recognized at present, especially in our anthroposophical domain. I should therefore like to point out that this threefold conception forms the central theme of my book titled Theosophy, from its first edition onward. You will all have read Theosophy, and will know that the structure of the whole book is based on this idea, as is enshrined especially in these words, quote, "The spirit is eternal. The body is subject to birth and death in accordance with the laws of the physical world. The soul life, which is subject to destiny, mediates the connection between these two during earthly life." Close quote. When I wrote these words, I considered it to be necessary to refer to this threefold principle as clearly as possible. For only by emphasizing this idea as one of special and even central importance is one in a position to understand, or to endeavor to understand, the cosmos as a whole, and in particular, the central event of our earthly evolution, the mystery of Golgotha. In the previous lecture, I explained to you the extent of the forces of resistance when the effort is made in our time to study both the world and man in such a way that the threefold principle of body, soul, and spirit is not merely of secondary importance, but is the central theme. I indicated the opposition to this in the central development of the West, and showed that the idea of the spirit was lost in the course of this development. I mentioned that through the 8th Ecumenical Council at Constantinople, the spirit, together with the very idea of the spirit, was eliminated from Western thought, and that this exclusion of the idea of the spirit has not merely influenced the development of religious ideas and feelings, but has had a profound effect on all the thinking of modern times. So that among the officially recognized schools of philosophy today, there are none that are able to distinguish between soul and spirit with any discernment. And even amongst those who would consider that they think in a completely different way, one encounters everywhere the rigid assumption, the sole source of which is the 8th Ecumenical Council, that man consists of a body and a soul. Anyone who has any real knowledge of the intellectual life of the West, not only in the way that is reflected in the more superficial realms of philosophy, but as it has implanted itself in the thoughts and feelings of everyone, even those who would not even think of devoting any time to philosophical ideas, is struck by the all-pervasive effects of the elimination of the idea of the spirit. And when, in recent times, a tendency developed to draw upon certain elements of Eastern wisdom, what was adopted was presented in such a light that it would be most unlikely to occur to anyone that the world and humanity had a threefold foundation of body, soul, and spirit. For in the division of man's being, derived purely from astral observation, into a dense body, an etheric body, an astral body, sthula sharira, linga sharira, prana, as it was then called, kama, kama manas, and the other divisions, which are an arbitrary collection of seven principles, there is no sign of what should be regarded as of the greatest importance, namely, that our conception of the world should be founded on the threefold idea of body, soul, and spirit. One can therefore justly say that this idea of man's threefold nature has been suppressed. It is true that much is said about the spirit today, but it is nothing but mere words. The problem is that people in our time are no longer able to distinguish between mere words and realities. It is for this reason that serious attention is given to explanations and analyses which are really nothing but kaleidoscopic combinations of words, as, for example, the philosophy of Eucken. The essential nature of the mystery of Golgotha cannot be understood if one is determined to reject the threefold idea of body, soul, and spirit. As I explained in the previous lecture, the rejection of the spirit was enshrined as a dogma with the Eighth Ecumenical Council, but it had long been undergoing preparation. That this came about is fundamentally connected with a necessary development in the intellectual life of the West. The simplest way to gain some idea of how one may approach the mystery of Golgotha from the standpoint of the threefold principle of body, soul, and spirit is to form a picture of how Aristotle, who stood at the summit of Greek thought, envisaged the soul. For Aristotle was, at the same time, the leading philosopher of the whole of the Middle Ages, and modern thought continues to be sustained by medieval concepts, however little people may want to admit this. Moreover, we can see that what was developing over the course of human history manifested itself in Aristotle a few centuries before the mystery of Golgotha, and that efforts were subsequently made by the leading intellectual figures of the Middle Ages to understand the mystery of Golgotha with the help of Aristotle's ideas. There is something of such great significance in these sequences of events that one really needs to take the trouble to investigate them in an unprejudiced way. What is Aristotle's conception of the human soul? I should like to express, in a few very simple words, Aristotle's view of the human soul, and, hence, what the Greeks had to say about it through the mind of this enlightened figure. Aristotle, and we have here the views of the most influential European, living a few centuries before the mystery of Golgotha, thought in the following way about the soul. When a human being comes into the world, when someone enters into incarnation through birth, or rather, through conception, he owes his physical existence initially to his father and mother. But, says Aristotle, only his bodily existence can come from his father and mother. The whole person could never arise as a result of the union of father and mother. Thus, according to Aristotle, the whole human being cannot originate from this union, for this individual has a soul. One part of this soul, for we need to be well aware that Aristotle distinguishes two parts of the soul, is completely bound up with the body, expresses itself through the body, and receives its impressions of the outside world through the sensory activity of the body. This part of the soul arises as a necessary byproduct through the person's material inheritance, which derives from the father and mother. This is not the case with the spiritual part of the soul, which participates, through thinking, in the general spiritual life of the world, in the, in quotes, nous, N-O-U-S, in the thinking of the world. This part of the soul is regarded by Aristotle as non-material, and it could never come into being from what is inherited from the father and mother, but it can only arise from the participation of God, or rather, in quotes, the divine, to use the Aristotelian expression, in human procreation by father and mother. This is how man, the whole human being, comes into the world. It is very important that one recognizes that Aristotle says explicitly that the whole human being originates through the collaboration of God with the father and mother. Man receives his spiritual, or as Aristotle calls it, his reasoning or intellectual soul, from God. This intellectual part of the soul, which comes into being through God, through divine collaboration, with each incarnation of an individual physical human being, is in a process of development between birth and death. When a person crosses the threshold of death, the bodily portion of his being is given over to the earth, and with the body also that part of the soul that is bound to the organs of the body, whereas the spiritual part of the soul continues in existence. This spiritual part of the soul, says Aristotle, lives on in such a way that it is transported into a different world from the one with which it was connected through the bodily organs, and continues to live an immortal existence. This immortal existence, according to Aristotle, is such that if the person concerned performed good deeds while he was in his body during his lifetime, he is able to look back on these good deeds that he has contributed to the cosmic order, but cannot change anything in this cosmic order in which he is placed. Indeed, we understand Aristotle rightly only if we interpret his ideas as meaning that the soul after death has to look for all eternity back at whatever good or evil deeds it may have performed. In the 19th century in particular, the greatest possible efforts were made from various sides to understand what Aristotle meant by this idea, for it is often difficult to understand him because of the way that he expressed himself. It can be said that Franz Brentano, who died recently, has, in his controversy with Eduard Zeller, endeavored throughout his life to gather together all the various elements which can enable one to gain a clear idea of what Aristotle thought about the relationship of the spiritual part of the human soul to the whole human being. And it must be emphasized that the way that Aristotle thought about this matter was passed on to the philosophy that was taught throughout the Middle Ages into modern times, and is still taught in certain ecclesiastical circles. Franz Brentano, who studied these ideas with a genuine intensity, inasmuch as they derive from Aristotle, came to the following conclusion. He made it clear that Aristotle was a figure whose inherent intellectual discipline enabled him to transcend materialism, and therefore was in no danger of succumbing to the belief that the spiritual part of the soul evolves out of what a person receives through his father and mother. There were, thought Brentano, only two possible ways for Aristotle to envisage the spiritual part of the soul. One possibility was this, that the spiritual part of the soul arises through a direct creation by God in collaboration with what comes from the father and mother, so that it comes into being through the influence of God upon the human embryo. And that this spiritual part of the soul does not perish at death, but embarks upon a path of everlasting life when the human individual passes through the portal of death. What other possibility would have been open to Aristotle, says Brentano, if he had not developed this idea? Brentano regards it as perfectly justified that Aristotle accepted it. There was only one other possibility, as a third one does not exist, according to Brentano. This second possibility is to accept the pre-existence of the soul, thus not merely its post-existence, but also its pre-existence, its existence in the spiritual world before birth or before conception. But Brentano very clearly recognizes that as soon as one even begins to admit that the soul exists before conception, in some way or other, there is no alternative but to accept that it does not only experience a single incarnation, but reappears again and again in successive earthly lives. There is no other possibility. And since, indicates Brentano, Aristotle in his later years rejected palingenesis, that is, reincarnation, he had no option but to accept creationism, the notion that the human soul is created completely anew every time that a human embryo is created, which is not at variance with post-existence, but denies pre-existence. Franz Brentano had originally been a priest, and was, I would say, one of the last of those who represented the positive side of Aristotelian scholastic philosophy. It therefore appears to him eminently reasonable that Aristotle rejected the doctrine of repeated earthly lives and recognized only creationism and the post-existence of the soul. This view, in all its various aspects, forms the basis of all Christian philosophy, insofar as this philosophy rejects the idea of repeated earthly lives. It is a strange phenomenon, both utterly tragic, but also deeply endearing, that such an eminently capable thinker as Franz Brentano, who had resigned from the ministry, makes endless efforts to clarify his ideas about creationism, and yet is completely unable to bridge the gulf that separated him from the doctrine of repeated earthly lives. Why is this? The reason is that despite the depth of his convictions and the energy and sharpness of his mind, the very idea of the Spirit was closed to him, and he was never able to formulate an idea of the Spirit as distinct from an idea of the soul. It is impossible to arrive at an idea of the Spirit without acknowledging the idea of repeated earthly lives. The notion of repeated earthly lives can be lost only if one loses the idea of the Spirit altogether. By the time of Aristotle, the idea of the Spirit had begun to be increasingly vague. From certain key passages in Aristotle's writings, one can observe how he always becomes obscure when he is speaking about the pre-existence of the soul. In such instances, his clarity always forsakes him. All this is connected with something immensely significant and profound, namely, with the actual course of human evolution. For during the centuries before the mystery of Golgotha, mankind had entered a stage of evolution when something of the nature of mist enshrouded the soul, when there was any mention of the Spirit. This phenomenon was not so marked then as it is now, when there is any reference to the Spirit. But the whole process of the corruption of thinking with respect to the Spirit was already starting to manifest itself at that time. And this, my dear friends, is connected with the fact that the evolution that mankind had undergone had led over the course of time to the soul becoming different from what it had been in the earliest period of human evolution on earth. In these primeval times, there was a direct experience of the Spirit because of the atavistic clairvoyance that existed then. It was not possible to doubt the reality of the Spirit. Indeed, it was no more possible to do so than to doubt the existence of the sense-perceptible world. It was merely a question of the degree of spiritual perception that people were able to attain. But in these former times, no one had the slightest doubt about any of this. And this conviction, which was founded on an immediate awareness of the Spirit, came to expression everywhere, in the mysteries, wherever they were cultivated. It is striking that one of the earliest of the Greek philosophers, Heraclitus, speaks of the mysteries in such a way that one can see that he is aware that in earlier times they were of immense significance to mankind, but that they had already declined from their former greatness. Thus enlightened Greeks were, even in these very early times, already speaking of the decline of the mysteries. There were various different aspects to these mysteries. However, only the central idea of the mysteries is of particular interest to us today. We shall dwell for a moment on this central idea of the mysteries as they were practiced until the time of the mystery of Golgotha and as late as the reign of Emperor Julian the Apostate. In recent times, certain aspects of the cultivation of these mysteries have been cited as having an anti-Christian quality. It has been pointed out that what is known as the, quote, Easter legend, close quote, as the mystery of Golgotha, hence the central legend of the suffering, death, and resurrection of Christ, was known everywhere in the mysteries. From this, the conclusion has been drawn that the Christian Easter mystery was merely a transference of ancient pagan mystery practices and customs to the figure of Jesus. Thus many people seemed to think that, although they did not doubt the truth of the idea, there was such a common identity between the two that they needed to say, quote, what the Christians say about the God called Christ, that he suffered, was crucified, and was resurrected, that his resurrection brings with it a hope and a longing for salvation, extended to all human beings, indeed, everything that Christians have made of ideas such as this is to be found in the mysteries, in all the different cults of the mysteries. Pagan customs have been brought together and fused into the Easter legend and transferred to the individual figure of Jesus of Nazareth. Close quote. In more recent times, this tendency has been taken even further, curiously, in official Christian circles, in that, for example, in the case of certain Protestant groups in Bremen, the historical existence of Jesus of Nazareth becomes a matter of indifference. People start saying that the various mystery legends and cults were brought together through a purely social process and had been centralized, and that in the early Christian community the legend of Christ had been created out of these old pagan legends. In the course of a discussion that took place here in Berlin some years ago, during the tragic history of recent years, all previous events have almost acquired mythical status and seem to be a distant memory, but the discussion was indeed only a few years ago, one could see that the official representatives of Christianity were declaring that there could be no question of attaching, you know, any real importance to an historical Jesus, but only to an, quote, idea of Jesus, close quote, which arose as an idea in the early Christian community through all manner of social impulses. As one studies the pagan mystery cults, it is very tempting to compare them with what emerged in the form of the Christian Easter mystery. This can be illustrated by a faithful description of the Phrygian Easter festivals. Other festivals could also be cited in addition to the Phrygian festivals, for there were a large number of such festivals. Firmicus, for example, gives an account of the Phrygian Easter festival in a letter to the sons of Constantine. The image of Attis, hence of a certain god, we do not need to investigate any further which god this was bound to the trunk of a tree and solemnly carried round in a procession in the course of a midnight ritual, and the sufferings of the god were then celebrated. During this time a lamb was placed beside the tree. At dawn the resurrection of the god was proclaimed. And whereas, on the previous day, when the god was bound to the tree and had therefore seemingly been consigned to death, there was a ritualistic outpouring of the most terrible lamentations. These cries were, on the following day, suddenly transformed into exuberant joy, when the resurrection of the god was celebrated. Firmicus relates that the image of the god Attis was buried elsewhere. At night, when the sorrow had reached its climax, a light was suddenly kindled, the tomb was opened, the god had risen. And the priest spoke the words, quote, "Take comfort, devout people, for the god has been saved, and you may be sure that you too will be saved." Close quote. No one could deny that these ritualistic festivals that were celebrated everywhere for centuries and centuries before the mystery of Golgotha took place have a great similarity with what was enacted as the Christian mystery of Easter. Because it was so appealing to think in this way, some people even believed that these widespread images and conceptions of the God who suffered, died, and resurrected had, in a certain sense, been formed into a unity through Christian influence and transferred to Jesus of Nazareth. Now, it is important to understand the real source of all these pagan pre-Christian rites. They can be traced far, far back to those times when the mysteries were developed from very deep ancient insights about the being of man and his relationship with the world as revealed to atavistic clairvoyance. At the time when the Phrygian festivals were celebrated, people only knew roughly as much about the real meaning of these rites as is known today in certain free Masonic temples about the ceremonies that take place there. Nevertheless, this can all be traced back to an originally grand vista of knowledge of the world and man, which is very difficult to comprehend today. For you need to consider that man does not merely live in his surroundings by virtue of his physical body and depend on his surroundings with respect to this body, but that his soul and spirit are also part of this environment. He derives his ideas and mental pictures from this outward environment. They become familiar to him, and he makes them his own. And for various reasons, he cannot free himself from them. Therefore, even with the best will in the world, it can be difficult to understand certain things, which, for these and other reasons, have been lost to the spiritual evolution of mankind. Modern natural science, I do not need to reiterate at every opportunity that I admire it, for I do indeed, despite my reservations, is concerned only with things at their most superficial level, and leads to no more than the most minimal understanding of their true nature. It is true that science has made considerable progress in certain areas, but this notion of, quote, considerable progress, close quote, only means that one has understood something or other. To be sure, one cannot but have admiration for a science that has developed wireless telegraphy, together with much that plays a considerable role in modern life. But one may legitimately ask, how would it be if we had not arrived at this situation? If we were to pursue this question, we would firmly come up against something that it is forbidden to speak about today. Modern science regards the wisdom of which the last corrupted vestiges survived in the mystery rituals to which I have referred as pure nonsense, as sheer foolishness. This may be so. But as Paul said, what human beings regard as foolishness may often be wisdom in the eyes of God. True insight into the nature of humanity and the world yields, among many other things, and today I want to emphasize those aspects that are of importance for an understanding of the mystery of Golgotha, a particular view of the human organism that does, of course, seem completely crazy to modern scientists. For the human organism has very significant differences from the organism of animals. I have already mentioned several differences, and today I specifically want to refer to one that relates particularly to the mystery of Golgotha. The human organism, as I have said, differs in significant ways from that of animals. For the animal organism, if one really studies it through spiritual scientific means, has within it the seeds of death. To put it another way, if you make a serious study of the animal organism in the light of spiritual science, you can see from the way that it is constituted that it has to pass through death in its particular manner, that it disintegrates and is given over to the elements of the earth. The death of an animal has nothing mysterious about it. It is no less understandable than that one can clearly perceive from studying an animal organism that the animal needs to eat and drink. That an animal has to die is apparent from the nature of its organism. This is not the case with the human organism. Of course, we are touching upon an area that must inevitably be totally incomprehensible to modern science. If you study the human organism with all the means of spiritual science, there is nothing, absolutely nothing in the human organism itself, which explains the necessity for death. We have to accept death simply as something that man experiences, but we cannot explain why it is that people die. Man was not originally born in order to die. Not even his outward organism was made for death. That death occurs in a person through an inner process cannot be explained from the being of man itself. It cannot be explained from the way that man's being itself is constituted. I know very well that this will be regarded today as perfectly crazy by all those who want to rise to scientific heights. Indeed, it is in general very difficult to discuss such matters, for they are actually connected with certain very deep mysteries. Even today, anyone wanting to form a relationship to such questions encounters something that can only really be expressed in the way that St. Martin, of whom I spoke here recently, writes in his book Des Erreurs et de la Vérité. Thus, in an important passage, where he is speaking about the consequences of human evolution that ensued from the event that took place in the spiritual world before man incarnated for the first time on the physical plane, he wrote the following words about this event in the super-earthly domain, which anyone who is intimately familiar with such matters will understand. Quote, "However much I may want to do as I am asked, the obligations that I have undertaken do not allow me to give any explanation whatsoever about this subject, and moreover I for my part would rather blush for man's transgressions than to speak of them." Close quote. In this context, St. Martin is being asked to speak about an offense committed by man before his first incarnation on earth. This he cannot do. Today it is possible, for certain reasons, to say much that St. Martin was not yet able to say, not because people have become better since his time, but for many other reasons. But if one wished to discuss a truth, such as that man was not born in order to die, in connection with everything else of relevance to this question, this would necessarily raise certain issues that modern ears are not as yet able to hear. Man is not born to die, and yet he dies. These words express something that is indeed an absurdity as far as modern scientists are concerned. But for someone who wants to arrive at a real understanding of the world, this is one of life's deepest mysteries. Man is not born in order to die. Nevertheless, he dies. This awareness that man is not born to die and yet dies flows as a hidden impulse through those ancient mysteries to which I have referred as the Attis mysteries. A possible way of understanding this enigma, that man is not born in order to die and yet dies, was sought in these mysteries, and they were expected to give an answer to this riddle. But why were these mysteries celebrated? They were celebrated in order that people might be able to hear something every year anew, something that they wanted to hear, wanted to feel, wanted to experience in their souls. What they wanted to be reminded of was that the time had not yet come when they had seriously to face the inexplicable problem of their death. So, what did someone with such beliefs expect from the priest of the Attis Mysteries? He had the instinctive certainty that the time would one day dawn on the earth when the enigma of death would have to be confronted in all seriousness. But this time had yet to come. And as the priest celebrated the sufferings and resurrection of the god, this act of celebration brought the comforting message that the time had not yet come when he had to grapple seriously with the mystery of death. It was common knowledge to these ancient times that the event described in what we may call a, in quotes, symbolic way in the Bible, at the beginning of the Old Testament, referred to a reality. The people of these ancient times knew this instinctively. It was only through modern materialism that this instinctive feeling that the description of the temptation by Lucifer refers to an actual event was lost. There can be no doubt that the intellectual crudities displayed in the materialistic interpretation of Darwinism are, to a very considerable degree, at variance with what should be regarded as the actual truth of this matter. For these crude, perverted ideas would have us believe that in former times there were animals of a certain kind which gradually evolved into the human beings of today. The story of the temptation in paradise does, of course, have no place in the materialistic interpretation of Darwinism. For only a very degenerate form of intellect could conceive of the idea that a primeval ape of whatever gender could have been seduced by Lucifer. Thus there was an instinctive certainty that behind the story that is told at the beginning of the Old Testament, a previous actual event or fact was concealed. And how was this fact experienced? It was felt that the nature of man's original physical organism was such that he was not mortal, but that through this fact something was added to his original organism which corrupted it, and thereby also implanted within it an impulse of mortality. Man became mortal as the result of a moral process, through what is generally, and we will return to this later, called original sin. Man did not become mortal in the way that the other beings of nature became mortal. He did not become mortal through natural or material processes, but rather through a moral process. His mortality originated from the soul. The animal soul, as the soul of a species, is immortal. It is embodied in the separate individual animal, which by virtue of its organs is immortal. The soul of a species departs from the dead animal as it had been embodied in it. But the organism of an animal as an individual organism is inherently constituted for death. This does not apply to the human organism to the same extent. The species soul, or human group soul, that lies at the foundation of the human organism has the inherent capacity to come to expression in the individual human being and endow him with immortality as an independent human organism. Man could only become mortal through a moral act originating in the soul. In a certain sense, man has to be endowed with a soul before he can become mortal. For as long as these ideas are regarded as abstract concepts, it is impossible to understand what is going on. Only if one makes the effort to grasp these phenomena as they actually are is it possible to comprehend them. Now, in ancient times, and also shortly before the mystery of Golgotha, when these mysteries were being celebrated, people were very clearly aware that man's soul causes him to die. The human soul is in a constant process of development over the ages. Of what does this development consist? It is a process whereby the soul increasingly corrupts the organism and plays an ever more prominent part in the corruption, which is the effect of its destructive influence upon the organism. People looked back to ancient times and said to themselves, a moral event has taken place, which has led to the soul becoming such that when it comes to dwell in the body through birth, it corrupts it, with the result that it does not live between birth and death as it would do if this corruption had not occurred. This situation has become worse and worse over the centuries and millennia. The soul has been increasingly corrupting the body. This is what they said. Because of this, it is more and more difficult for the soul to find its way back to the spirit. As human evolution proceeds, it corrupts the body more and more. And because of this, the body is impregnated ever more deeply with the seeds of death. And a time must come when human souls will, once they have spent so much of their existence between birth and death, no longer be able to find their way back to the spiritual world. In ancient times, this moment was awaited with fear and dread. The worry was that with succeeding generations, the generation would eventually arise that had souls that had corrupted their bodies to such a degree and had impregnated them so intensively with death that it would no longer be possible to find the path back to the divine world. This generation will indeed come, they said to themselves, and they wanted to be reassured whether such a moment was nearer or further away. This was the purpose of the Attis rites and similar customs. The aim was to find out whether there was still enough of a divine nature in human souls, that the time had not yet come when they had eradicated all trace of their divine heritage and could no longer find their way back to the gods. It was therefore of immense significance when the priest said, quote, take comfort, devout people, for the god has been saved, and you may be sure that you too will be saved, close quote. With these words, the priest wanted to say, quote, see, the god still has influence on the world. Human souls have not come to the point of completely breaking off their connection from the god, whose resurrection is ever renewed, close quote. This is what the priest wanted to tell them. It was a message of comfort that the priest sought to impart. Quote, the god is still within you, close quote, he said. When we speak of these matters, we are unearthing feelings and emotions from former periods of human evolution of such infinite depth that people in our time, whose interests have become completely externalized, no longer have the slightest idea what those who were living then had to contend with. Although they may have known nothing of what is called culture nowadays, and may also have been completely illiterate, they nevertheless had such feelings. And in the mystery schools, where the last traditions deriving from ancient clairvoyant wisdom were preserved, the pupils who were being initiated were told that if evolution were to continue in the way it has been progressing under the influence of that moral event at the beginning of earthly evolution, one would need to be prepared for the time when human souls would turn from God to the world that they themselves create, when they bring death to the human organism through their ever-intensifying corruption of the physical body. Souls would unite with the earth, and through the earth, with what is called the underworld, and as a result they would be lost. But since these schools still preserved the wisdom of the spirit, there was the awareness that man consists of body, soul, and spirit. What I have been telling you now relates to the soul, not to the spirit, for the spirit is eternal and has its own laws. From their spiritual insight, people were enabled to say that souls will disappear into the underworld, but the human spirit will appear again in ever-repeated earthly lives. A future scenario of earthly evolution is approaching, when human spirits would incarnate again, but they would look back upon all these soul qualities that had formerly existed here on earth. Souls would be lost, and there would no longer be any souls. spirits would reincarnate, which would cause the human body to be activated after the fashion of an automaton. Without the way that they activate the human body being felt and experienced by the soul. What, on the other hand, were the feelings of those who were drawn to the Christian Easter mystery? Their feeling was that if nothing were to happen on the earth, other than what had already done so, human beings would in future reincarnate without souls. They therefore awaited something else, something that could not arise from within earthly evolution, but was to enter earthly life from without, namely the mystery of Golgotha. Their expectation was that a being would enter earthly evolution who would rescue the soul, rescue it from death. There was no need to save the spirit from death, but it was essential that this happened for the soul. This being who now forged a connection with earthly evolution from without, through the body of Jesus of Nazareth, was experienced as the Christ, who had appeared for the salvation of souls. Thus Christ is that being with whom man can unite his soul, so that through its union with Christ it loses its power to corrupt the body, and all that had been lost can gradually be restored once more. That is why the mystery of Golgotha is in the middle of earthly evolution. From the beginning of earthly evolution until the mystery of Golgotha, more and more is lost as a corrupting influence increasingly takes hold of the soul, with the object of making people automata of the spirit. While from the mystery of Golgotha until the end of earthly existence is the time when what had been lost before the mystery of Golgotha is again gradually brought together. Thus, when the earth has reached the end of its evolution, human spirits will incarnate for the last time in bodies which will once again be immortal. This is how the Easter mystery was experienced. For this to happen, it was, however, necessary for the power that had caused the moral corruption of the soul to be overcome. This was achieved through what is recognized by Christianity as the event of Golgotha. There were some important words heard by the original Christians who were familiar with these matters. They were expecting an event deriving from wider spheres that would bring the possibility that the corrupting influence on the soul would be brought to an end. The words of Christ on the cross, quote, "It is finished," close quote, rang out to them as a sign that now the time had come when the corrupting power of the soul had lost its force. It was an extraordinary event, an event that encompasses vast, unfathomed mysteries. For vast questions appear when we survey the mystery of Golgotha. We shall see as we pursue our studies further that the mystery of Golgotha cannot be conceived of without the risen Christ. The risen Christ, that is the essence of the mystery of Golgotha. Paul's words strike to the heart of the matter, quote, "And if Christ did not rise again, then our proclamation is without content, and the power of faith in your hearts is an illusion," close quote. The risen Christ is unique to Christianity, and without the risen Christ, Christianity has no reality. The death of Christ is also an integral part of it. But how is this event portrayed, and how must it be portrayed? An innocent man was put to death, he suffered and died. Those who put him to death clearly bear a heavy burden of guilt. After all, it was an innocent person who was put to death, and his tormentors bear a weighty responsibility. But what does this guilt represent for mankind? Salvation. For if Christ had not died, mankind would not have been saved. As one beholds this unique event of Golgotha, one is led to the realization that the killing of Christ is at once the greatest healing deed that has taken place for humanity and the greatest guilt that it must necessarily bear. Thus the greatest benefit coincides here with the weightiest burden of guilt. A superficial way of thinking may well, of course, fail to see this. But for those who do not dwell merely on the surface of things, this represents a profound riddle. The most momentous murder in the whole of human evolution has turned out to be for the salvation of mankind. Let this riddle reverberate through your feelings. If one really wants to understand the mystery of Golgotha, it is also necessary, at least, to try to make sense of this riddle. A powerful key to solving it can be found in the paradigmatic words spoken by Christ from the cross, quote, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." Close quote. We shall see that the answer to the momentous question as to why the most appalling murder has become the source of mankind's salvation lies in the right understanding of these words. If you reflect on all of this, you will begin to understand that one has to approach the mystery of Golgotha with the threefold conception of body, soul, and spirit. For Christ died for the souls of human beings. He restores these souls to the spiritual world from which they would have been completely cut off if he had not come. Morality would have disappeared from the world. In a body that behaves like an automaton, the spirit would be impelled by a necessity devoid of all morality, and nothing would be experienced on a soul level. Christ had the task of redeeming human souls. Should one be surprised if 3 centuries before the mystery of Golgotha, the most enlightened of Greeks, Aristotle, did not speak accurately about the soul and its connection with the spirit, in view of the crisis that loomed before the human soul? Is it surprising that what he said about the soul was incorrect if human souls were confronted by this crisis? And Aristotle did not know that the Savior of souls was at hand. One should surely not be surprised at this. Another explanation will be necessary to explain why Aristotle's erroneous explanation of the relationship between the soul and the spirit persisted for so long. Christ's significance for the human soul is manifested to us in the light that enables us to discern man in his threefold being of body, soul, and spirit, and in the inner relationship that exists between objectively real events and moral events, a relationship which will never be recognized for what it is unless we acknowledge man's threefold being of body, soul, and spirit. I have today merely been able to give you a preparation for explaining how deeply one needs to penetrate into the human soul, if one is even to some small degree to be able to understand the mystery of Golgotha. I believe that it is of very deep concern to us, specifically in our time, and we may perhaps take advantage of the present Easter festive period to enter more deeply into these matters, insofar as this is possible today. Much can perhaps be addressed initially on a feeling level, which can be a seed that will mature in future periods of human evolution. For there are many respects in which we must realize that we shall only gradually become fully awake, that we are living in a time when there is much that we do not fully comprehend, whatever the particular theme may be. This is evident from the difficulty that people have today in forming a clear conception of events that are approaching us in a fully conscious way. Unfortunately, it is impossible to indicate, even in bare outline, how the grievous event of which the people of Europe, or at any rate of Central Europe, have recently heard, should be understood in a clearly conscious way. Matters of this nature are for the most part experienced as though in a state of sleep. But it is not possible to speak further about them here. My purpose today was merely to evoke some questions, in order to use them as a basis for speaking next time about the mystery of Golgotha. The end of Lecture 9.